Welcome back to the Anchor Drop Podcast. This is Joe. I'm here with Tim.
Hello.
And Stephen is actually doing the homily on Sunday, but he was not available to record today. So you're getting me and Tim, our hot take on this passage. And then we'll let Stephen sort out, you know, correct us, get it all straightened out on Sunday when he does the homily.
He's going to answer all the really hard questions.
Right. So we're up to day six now, starting in Genesis 1, verse 24, and going through the end of the chapter in verse 31. And I'll start off by reading the whole passage, and then we'll just kind of work our way through it and process this section a verse at a time. All right, beginning in verse 24. Then God said, "Let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind, cattle and creeping things and the beasts of the earth, each according to its kind, and it was so. And God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female. He created them. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And God said, see, I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed. To you it shall be for food. Also to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth in which there is life, I have given every green herb for food. And it was so. Then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day." All right, there's a lot here.
Yes,
God
did
a lot on day six. I would have broken, if I was God, I would have broken this out into 2 days, then the animals, and then, then the man had an 8-day week, you know, with the day of rest. But God somehow fit it all into 1 day. So let's start with the animals, verse 24. Then God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind, cattle and creeping thing and beast of the earth, each according to its kind. And it was so. What do you got for us here, Tim? What are these three categories?
Well, again, we have the same kind of thing we had with day three with the plants. Of the categories are not necessarily the way we would classify things now, that it's not a Linnaean classification system, but this is a rough classification in terms of how we see them and how we humans relate to the world. So we have cattle, which are the domesticated animals, the ones that we keep and this is an interesting thing. Because the story that we tell in like an evolutionary biology is mm-hmm. that all of these were wild beasts and we have turned some of them into things that we find more useful.
Yeah.
No, God made domestic animals.
That's right.
He made, and that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to tame the wild ones. We all like a challenge and we do. We do some of that too, but God made certain animals on purpose to be domestic help for us. And then he made wild beasts that are not really that. And then he made, excuse me, he made creepy crawlies.
Yeah. And the creepy crawlies are, you know, I think you're supposed to read this in terms of a description, you know, these are description of what they do. So it's not like the creepers are bugs. The creepers are things that creep. And so you could put into this category the mouse and the spider and, you know,
and the lizards
and the lizards. Yes. Yeah.
If it goes creepy crawly around the earth.
Yeah. It's a creep.
Yep. It's It's one of those things.
Yeah. And again, and likewise, wild beasts is going to include your lions and tigers and bears, as well as, you know, apes and monkeys and, you know, on and on, any number of possums and things that don't get, you know, you're not keeping as pets. They're not exactly creeper, you know, tiny little creepers. But they're somewhere in between.
The Tyrannosaur counts as a wild beast, right?
Yeah.
And we're thinking, okay, but lizards all in a, well, no, you have the little creepy ones and you have the wild beast lizards.
Yeah.
And those are different. You relate to them differently.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's, you know, there's nothing wrong with the classifications of breaking them down by, you know, mammals and reptiles and the Linnaean classifications in the all the way down like that. But I wonder if sometimes that classification gets in the way of seeing the world in terms of how God created it for our actual use, you know, like there's some higher scientific way of seeing the world that we should strive for. And we miss how things are actually broken down in terms of its relationship to mankind, like it is here.
Yeah. It's well, and they're both lenses worth looking through.
Yeah.
And the Linnaean, I mean, Carolus Linnaeus was a believer.
Right.
The Linnaean classifications come of a Christian looking at the world and just being super curious about what God made.
Right.
And if we take these things on their own terms and take us out of the picture for a second and look at just what's here, what did God do here? You come up with a different set of classifications than you do if you put us in the picture and just classify according to how we relate to them. Those are both useful lenses to look through. It's not like one is right and one is wrong or one is better. And that's the important thing to keep in mind, is it's not, one is not better than the other. They're both, God made a world that is worth looking at through multiple different lenses.
Yeah. And it's similar to the, if we go back to, I think it was day four, when God made the sun and the moon and the stars, the way they're described here, you know, if you look up at the sky, what you see are, you know, constellations. You see individual stars, you see planets that move in a different pattern than the rest of the stars. And then you see, of course, the sun and the moon. If you don't have magnification, what you got is what's described, in the extent of what you have is what's described on day four. If you have magnification, then now you have, you know, gas giants and, you know, and on and on, all sorts of different types of stars and galaxies and all these things. Not that one is better than the other, but there, I wonder if there's not a more foundational or an order of learning kind of thing here for that. Like if the first thing you learn in school, you take an astronomy class and you pull out the telescope and you look up at the sky and you start studying, you know, different types of planets and stars, and you never get like, you never learn the constellations. You never learn the phases of the moon. You just learn all the stuff that is, you know, typically in, you know, more in an astronomy class where you're using a telescope and stuff. Nothing wrong with that set of lenses. But if you skip that first one and never really learn it, then and you take that as the primary lens, I think you're missing something significant in terms of how you're supposed to relate to it. So take that same thing and apply it here to,
yes,
to the animals. And actually notice, like, what I think the Linnaean classification misses is what you pointed out with God creating domesticated animals. He created certain animals to relate to man in a certain way, you know, doesn't particularly identify those different things. And we don't ever learn this in school, you know, we do at Hammersmith, but
right.
But as a general, we're not learning this classification system. We're learning the other and taking it as primary when,
yep,
I think there's something really significant about breaking down the categories the way God gives them to us.
Yes. Well, and you get really interesting as you dig, you get really interesting things. A teacher of mine gave a lecture once that he subtitled "Why I Hate Zebras." he's a black man, and he was talking about how civilization developed in across Eurasia differently than in Africa. And one of the big, big differences is that zebras can see more. Their eyes are set differently in their skull than horses.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, zebras are very difficult to domesticate and horses are easy to domesticate. And so, like, this is a massive, massive difference in how civilization developed in Eurasia as opposed to how it developed in Africa.
Right.
Because you get domesticated and, you know, oh, you get a work beast that's really easy, and zebras just are not that.
Right.
And he was like, man, we could have come out so far ahead if we could have domesticated the zebra. But it's a wild horse, and that's just what it is.
Right.
That particular, in the Linnaean classification, that's very close to.
Yeah.
The ponies the Mongols rode across the steppes, right?
Mm-hmm.
They look a lot similar, but in terms of Genesis categories, there's three big categories, and these are in two different categories.
That's right. Yeah.
In terms of how they relate to us, and that has real impact.
Yeah.
In terms of downstream, like the development of civilizations, you don't have steppe nomads on the Serengeti Plains.
Mm-hmm.
And you do across the, and you totally could. It's grassland. You could have nomads thundering across on ponies if you could domesticate zebras.
Yeah.
It would totally be a thing. And it's just not, because of the difference in these. It makes a big difference, actually.
Yeah. I remember when I was in, I think I was in Tijuana once, and I saw that you could get a free zebra rides. Or you could pay for a zebra ride, but it was actually just a white donkey with black stripes painted on it.
That's awesome.
So they figured out a way to do it, but
that's hilarious. Hey, okay. If it Instagrams, right?
That's right. Okay. So the other thing, this is maybe this getting too far afield, but the other thing the Linnaean system does is you talk about the animals in terms of how closely related they are to one another, even cross species or cross kinds. And it lends itself very nicely to, talking about it in terms of they're related to each other in evolutionary terms, when they may not be related at all. They have similar features, but there's not a genetic, relationship. These animals didn't develop one into another and that kind of thing. Where I think what this gives you is, sticking with just the plain utility of the beasts, you get a creation oriented take on it more easily.
Yes. Although that also, like, in defense of Linnaeus here, as a believer who I'm pretty sure predates Darwin, I'd have to check.
Uh-huh.
But he's not thinking in evolutionary terms, and it, like, we get that system presented in evolutionary terms, but
right,
because it's been filtered through decades and decades and decades of evolutionary thought. But that's not the way it was originally designed.
Yeah.
And it would be worth, this is one of those places where it's worth going back and reading some of the classics. It's, it would be tough sledding, but reading some of the early Christians' work on this kind of thing and seeing how did they talk about it.
Yeah.
Back before everybody was trying to frame it in Darwinian terms.
Right. The other thing you have here that differs from the Linnaean classification is it talks just about reproduction according to its kind. It doesn't mm-hmm. talk about genus or species. What is a kind, Tim, and how is it related to those categories, or is it at all?
Differentially related to those categories. Kind of depends.
Uh-huh.
Because we will talk about there's a whole argument about the theoretically the definition of a species is that it breeds true and consistently.
Mm-hmm.
But depending on how we carve, how we draw those lines, sometimes we'll say subspecies, sometimes like the Florida panther is this unique genetic strain, but you can 100% breed Florida panthers with mountain lions from Oregon. And
oh yeah,
like, and they have kids, and like the kids are not sterile. It's not like making a mule.
Mm-hmm.
You get, and then people get all up in arms about it because that is creating something that's different from the particular characteristics of the Florida panther. So because we've been filtering our classification system through decades and decades, you know, centuries actually, of Darwinian thought, we just don't draw the lines in the right places in terms of the way scripture presents things.
Yeah.
Scripture presents the idea that what God made are different kinds of things and that those kinds of things reproduce after their kind. And we don't pay as much attention as we maybe could to, you know, that's in terms of how scripture talks about things, that's where the lines actually are.
Yeah.
So all your domestic dogs, you know, to everybody's great surprise, depending on which, like, you wouldn't believe it, right? You get a pair of very different domestic dogs in this very different breeds in the same room. And you're like, these two can crossbreed. And everybody's like, no, come on. Don't be stupid. Well, but they can.
Yeah.
Like a Cocker Spaniel and a poodle should not be able to crossbreed, but they do. And it works just fine.
Yeah.
And then you have a cockapoo and then you have a whole new breed, right? It's wild how much variation within a kind you can get when you really pay attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is mostly something that we don't pay attention to because like dogs and cats and a few other domestic animals are the things that we do actually pay lots of attention to crossbreeding.
Yeah.
No, but nobody is trying to make specific breeds of panther.
My understanding is that the kinds are typically broader than classification, than species. And so, for example, you would get like all cats, you know, from lions and to tigers to panthers to your kitty cat are likely all from some, you know, some single kind, some pair that came off the ark. We're talking, you know, post flood here, we're talking about something that had the genetic potential to produce all this variety. And you're not, you know, you're not going to see a tiger interbreeding with a kitty cat, but if you follow that, you know, follow that back up, all of that genetic potential was built into that individual kind. And so you get much more variation within kinds.
Potentially. I'm not expert on this. And this is one of the things that happens as you get further down the rabbit, down breeding more and more, more selectively is what you're doing a lot of times is losing genetic information.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to put it back once you lost it. And so you can get down in this hole where things that came from the same thing can't produce viable offspring with each other anymore because enough of the wrong information has gotten lost on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
That they're not patching each other anymore. It's just not working. And the argument at the level you're talking about would be that that's happened. Cause this is a fun thing to look up. You can crossbreed lions and tigers.
Right.
It does not produce offspring that breed true, and it produces different things depending on which one's the mother and which one's the father.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a liger and a tigon, and I forget which is which. and these are things you can look up, and they're interesting because you get something, you know, with like a lion's mane but tiger stripes and on its flanks and weird, mm-hmm. interesting things. But those tend in turn like mules to be sterile.
Yeah.
and not really breed true. And the question is that because we're crossing a kind that just wasn't meant to work, or are we within a kind, but we've lost enough information that it just no longer works? And that's an interesting question. And there are people who, okay, the thing you're going to search, the word for kind is bara, or the English term that they use in creation science is baramin, B-A-R-A-M-I-N. Baraminology is the study of created kinds. Google that, see what you come up with.
Yeah.
There's a whole field there, and I don't really know what the state of things is in there.
Yeah. And a lot of it comes down to, you know, the stuff has been figured out to the extent that it has been figured out, because they're answering the question, how they fit all these animals on the ark. Because the easy and obvious, you know, argument against it is, how are you going to fit every single species onto the ark? And the creationist response is, well, kinds are
brought. But you don't have to.
You're right.
Like, we don't have to have a poodle and a German shepherd and a Cocker spaniel.
Okay. I think we've covered verse 25 enough too here.
Yeah.
All right. So on to 39, or sorry, 26. Wow, my eyes are getting bad. Then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. All right. We're getting into the creation of mankind. And now, what, Tim, it's talking about God creating man, but it doesn't differentiate between man and woman. Why not?
Well, I mean, as it turns out, it does.
Well, yes. It's not... Yeah, it does in this
very quickly.
Yeah,
but we start with man as opposed to everything else,
right?
Man as opposed to animals.
Uh-huh.
And then we move into male and female, he created them.
Yeah.
So we image God together, the man as opposed to cattle, wild, you know, beasts of the earth and creeping things. We are the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
God, well, when you make the universe, when you paint a picture, there's a corner and you can sign your name, right?
Yeah.
When you make the universe, where's the corner that you sign your name in? God puts his signature on the creation.
Yeah.
And this is how he does it.
That's right.
He makes humanity. And the nature of the signature is that we rule over the creation. We have dominion over everything that he made, over the whole earth, over all the inhabitants of the earth, the fish, the birds, the everything he filled the earth with, we have dominion over.
Yeah.
And then may it created male and female.
Mm-hmm.
So we are not within our, which is obviously not unique to us, birds, fish. Like we see this reflected elsewhere in creation as well. But this is the place where it gets mentioned in the creation account. The genders, of which there are two, are created by God and created in that particular way.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that we inherit, not something we construct.
Yeah.
And part of the image of God is being male and female together and relating together to the creation.
Yeah.
Having dominion over all the earth and everything that creeps on the earth is not a job two people can fulfill, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm poaching on later verses here, but he made us to have dominion over everything. There's the maleness and the femaleness are going to become important to fulfilling that.
Yeah. One of the exercises I like when I'm teaching this passage to kids, the exercises I like to run them through is just observing some simple grammar here, singular and plural, you know, singular and plural. So I'll say, let us, okay, kids, singular or plural, us is plural, make man singular in our plural image, according to our plural likeness, let them plural. So now it changes. So now it changes the creation of man from singular to plural. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air. And then going on to verse 27. So God singular created man in his image, singular in his image, image of God. He created him singular, male and female. He created them plural. So we have this weird switching back and forth, both in reference to God, singular and plural, and man, singular and plural here as well. What's your, what's your take on that, Tim?
Well, we have an early introduction of a riddle that is ultimately going to resolve into the doctrine of the Trinity, right? And you're not going to get the doctrine of the Trinity out of Genesis 1.
Right.
You're going to, if Genesis 1 was all you had, we would be hard pressed to come up with that. But you are going to, upon further revelation, look back at Genesis 1 and go, oh. So right from the beginning, right? The Spirit, you know, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The Spirit of God hovers over the waters. And then the Word of God speaks, right? So we have the Father, the Spirit, and the Word already in the first few verses. And you wouldn't get that if this was all you had.
Yeah.
But as it develops later, and we look back, we're like, oh, there it is. Yep. So it's not hugely disturbing to us. Like you have to do that running through the singulars and plurals, because we read that and we don't think anything of it.
Yeah.
Like, because God is, like, there's one God and there are three persons. And so the account switches back and forth between singulars and plurals, and we're not disturbed at all.
Right.
Because that's how it is. And it switches back between singular and plural in the image of God, because we are imaging singularity and plurality, and we're going to get more detail on that in chapter 2.
Yeah.
But here in chapter 1, we're imaging both the oneness of God and the multiple persons of God. Humanity captures that in a particular way. We are a reflection of something in the Godhead that we don't of course render that perfectly, or we would, you know, there would be another Trinity.
Right.
But we are a created reflection of the Trinity. And that comes out in the language.
Yeah. Okay, now rolling into, I'm going to take my glasses off to see this here. Verse 28. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over everything that moves on the earth. So first we had God talking to himself, and tell, you know, let us make man and let them have dominion. And now he creates mankind, and then God speaks to them. And just like he has done with other parts of creation, he starts with a blessing and a commandment. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply. I love that God's first word, the first words God speaks to his creation are words of blessing. And at the same time, a command to fulfill.
Yeah, commission. Go get it.
Go get it.
Yes. And this is something like you can man on the street this. This is fun. There are still enough people who know enough about the biblical creation story that if you go out and you're like in the Bible where it talks about creation, what's the first thing God says to humanity? And almost everybody, you can do this in churches.
Yeah.
Almost everybody's going to tell you, don't eat off that tree.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing God said.
Yeah.
Well, no, it isn't. No. The first thing we're given as we read the account, the first thing we're given that God says is a blessing and a commission.
Mm-hmm.
And it tells you something about church culture and the general state of our grasp of the Bible, but also just about the way that we think, like in church culture, that we think first of the prohibition.
Yeah.
Don't do that as the first thing. When what God presents first, if you just read the story from the beginning, the first thing God shows you is a blessing and a commission.
Mm-hmm.
And we would do well, like this is a thing that needs to get into your parenting. It needs to get into your friendships. It needs to get into your marriage. Prohibitions can be really important, but blessing and commission, like where can you lead with blessing and commission rather than prohibitions?
Yeah. And this is a commission to come along with God on what he's doing here. You know, it's an invitation to play this game, to engage in this battle, to do this thing, this beautiful world that I've just created. Look at this thing I've just made.
Yes. You know? And I made you as my signature. Yeah. Now go be the signature.
Go be the signature. Yeah. Have rule over it. Just like I rule over all things. Take authority over this place. This magnificent place. Trees and flowers and grass and fish and birds and creeping things and beasts and all the wild animals. Go out and you now have a mission. You have a mission in life. With people, like people have to have a mission. And that goes back to here, right? You know, everybody mm-hmm. knows, like, if you don't have a mission in life, you're going to be lazy or flail around or, you know, get sucked up into addiction or whatever. You got to have a mission. God's made us that way, but he gave us a pretty awesome one right here from the very beginning.
Yes. Well, and we see this, I remember the guy who was the youth pastor when my sister was going through high school, I was working with as one of his volunteers in the youth group at the time. And I remember him saying to me off the cuff, these suburban kids, he's like, rural kids don't have this problem particularly because they have real work to do. But these suburban kids, it's like nobody will let them do anything consequential.
Right.
And they're at an age where they're built to do something consequential. And they need something that important in their lives, and they are going to elevate something to that level of importance. Mm-hmm. And if you don't give them something that belongs at that level of importance, they will find something else and make it stupidly important. And all of the adults, he said, all of the adults will look at them making stupid things important and be like, see, that's why we don't trust them with anything. Mm-hmm. That is the wrong answer. You have to trust them with something that matters.
Yeah.
In order to restore a sense of proportion, because they're old enough to have a mission.
Mm-hmm.
And they're gonna, like, if all you let them do is dress themselves, then they're gonna have that mission about the brand of clothes they wear.
Yeah.
You want them to have that mission about feeding somebody who's hungry, caring for somebody who's sick, doing something that actually matters and benefits the community. And if you don't give them that, they will make stupid things important.
Mm-hmm.
We're built for this, and we're not even out of the first chapter of the Bible.
Yeah.
And God's giving two people the entire planet. Like, how does it get bigger than that?
That's right. All right. On to verse 29, and we get a revisiting of previous what God had created on some previous days here, and having God pass that on to man. And God said, "See, I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed. To you it shall be for food. Also, to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth in which there is life, I have given every green herb for food, and it was so. Then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day. So we have seed-bearing plants and fruit-bearing trees again here, now given specifically to man for food.
And then also to everything else for food.
Yep.
And notably, this is one of the differences that we'll see when we come off the ark. We'll see this commission repeated, but like theme music in a movie, it's a little different when you play it again.
Yeah.
And there will be some things added to it then that are not here. Now here, the plants are food.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all you're getting. As far as we can tell, at this point, everything is vegetarian.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, we observed the previous verses that God gives them a mission, but he also gives them the source of life. And like, what a wild world that we live in, where food that you can actually eat just grows on trees. You know, when I was growing up and I wanted to buy something, my dad said, "Do you think money grows on trees?" That would be a wild world, right? If money grew on trees, but actually something far more immediately useful to us grows directly on the trees. Like the food, you can just grab it off the tree and you can eat it. Fruit grows on trees. That's cool.
It is very cool. And it's one of the things I love about growing up with the parents that I did is that we learned, like, we knew where all the wild fruit grew in our neighborhood. We had the experience of hiking the Appalachian Trail and finding wild cherries or finding apples growing wild or peaches growing wild and just chowing down on a, you know, something from a tree you just found as you're hiking along.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. We live in a world where the things you need for life, like water falls from the sky and food grows on trees, literally. Grows
up out of the ground. You can, yep. And from the, you can pick. And I did, what's today, Wednesday? So 2 days ago, I was hiking up in Guanella Pass and ate some wild dandelion greens. Just literally picked them off the ground and ate them. You can just do that.
Yeah. Yep. And we conclude the last day here with, and God saw everything that he'd made, and it says it was very good. Now that we're at the conclusion of the creation process, it's not just good anymore. It's complete, and so it's very good.
It's very good. Everything comes together. This is also something that should catechize your tastes. So our relationship to the creation changes, and with the fall, and that's important, but you should not just hate parts of the creation that God made.
Mm-hmm.
God made spiders. You can smack it with a magazine when there's, you know, it's a black widow and it's in your living room. Well, you know, we're going to take some dominion here.
Yeah,
that's fine. But you're not allowed to just hate it.
Yeah.
God made that. God likes it. I should not hate things that God likes.
Yeah.
I should not. This is something you run into with kids all the time. Like, it's one thing to smack a spider or an ant that's crawling across your living room floor, but if it's outside where it belongs, doing its own thing, you got no business stomping on ants on the sidewalk just to be doing it.
Right.
God made those. God likes those. You're going through a museum, you know, stomping on little sculptures that God made. What are you doing?
That's right. And God, like, you can now successfully navigate the world without, you know, encountering a lot of animals if you want to in the city, you know. And if you really want to, like, a, you know, having kids, kids always want pets. And there's a part of me that goes, well, but if we didn't have a dog, then we don't have to figure out how to, you know, how to get the dog taken care of when we go out of town. And, you know, there's a lot of hassles that come along with taking dominion over animals, you know, actually having dominion over animals. But it's something that God specifically given here for mm-hmm. man to do, as almost as like the only thing, like take dominion over the animal, over the animals. He's and so if we want to be like God, like, it's not just, you can't hate those things. You got to figure out a way to actively incorporate them into your life to the extent that's possible, you know?
And you'll see this in your, like you said, you'll see this in your kids.
Oh yeah.
Like, your kids are going to beg for hamster, guinea pig, fish, dog, cat, pony. Like, it's not always realistic. Right. But it's built into them. They want that.
Yeah.
It's a very, very rare kid that just isn't interested in pets at all.
No.
I mean, maybe, I don't know that I've ever met a kid like that. Maybe there are some.
Yeah. There's some that like it more than others, I can say, even among my own kids.
Sure.
But yeah, they all like pets.
it's built into us to want that. And that's reflective of who God built us to be in the creation.
Yep. All right. So that concludes Genesis chapter 1, and we'll let all the things that we missed or got wrong, we'll have Stephen figure those out for us on Sunday.
Amen. All right.